I'm Laura Vinroot Poole, and this is What We Wore.
Isabel Wilkinson Shore is the founder of Attersey and a journalist turned fashion industry entrepreneur. Isabel shares how a single conversation changed the course of her career and how she overcame imposter syndrome to become a remarkable designer and businesswoman. You grew up in Manhattan.
I grew up in Manhattan and I still live in Manhattan, and I had a brief stint in Los Angeles,
but oh, wow.
I've never lived anywhere else other than
it's funny because we've had over, I don't know, 150, 170 of these podcasts, and we don't have that many native New Yorkers, which is kind of weird and interesting, I think, actually.
I feel grateful that I landed back here, but it was important for me to live somewhere else. And I always say to native New Yorkers, like, get out at some point, even if you think you're going to come back and experience another part of the world. And
I have a 20-year-old daughter, and I do recognize that I need her to go away because I would love her to come back at some point. And it's so hard to push them out and want them to do that. But I know that's true. So tell me, what was it like growing up in Manhattan?
It was wonderful. I grew up downtown. My parents were in the arts. They started an art school called the New York Academy of Art. My dad would pick me up at Grace Church School and walk me down to the academy, which was then on Astor Place. And I would do my homework there, and I would often terrorize the live nude model classrooms where students were drawing from life. And I thought it was extremely funny as a middle schooler to run through the nude portrait sittings.
They started an art school together. Were they artists?
My dad had worked at galleries, and my mom had taught art history and architecture for many years. And they ended up with some other people, including Warhol, and formed the New York Academy of Art in the 80s. And that was sort of the backdrop of my childhood. Downtown New York looked very different then than it does now. But it was a wonderful childhood, and I'm an only child. I felt I was always raised at the adult table, so to speak. Yeah, and my parents are still very close to us today, and we've since moved. You know, it feels in many ways like I have a very tight nuclear family.
What was your first recognition of fashion, I guess, style?
It's such a good question. I looked to my mom and her sister, my aunt, Barbara, very much as kind of style icons of mine, and their mom, my grandmother, Sylvia, and her like bedecked little sister, Aunt Rosh, who was always like dripping in like jazzy jewelry. Those were my like earliest style memories, I would say. But as the only child, as I grew up, my aunt also didn't have children. So I just started to get hand-me-downs at a really young age. And, I'm very lucky to just kind of be wearing things that they wore throughout the years. My mom actually used to also sew a lot of clothes for me when I was little with these sewing kits. I forget the name of the sewing kit now, but she made every Halloween costume for me. And then when I was really little, sewed a lot of kind of toddler smocks and things for me. And so I remember helping her with that. And so kind of fashion and style was always just sort of around and a present thing. And although I never professionally learned to sew, it was an important part of the backdrop.
How did you start to understand that this could be a career for you? Like, what was your first indication that this could be a path that you could take? And I guess growing up in Manhattan, especially around, you know, New York Art League, like, you must have understood that artists that could be a career for everybody.
Yeah, I feel like I saw a multiplicity of creatives in different fields early on. And even if I wasn't fully aware that it was mapping a career trajectory for me at the time, I realize now, looking back, that it's sort of set a framework for who you could be.
And so you started out in journalism.
Yes, I graduated from college and went straight to journalism school.
And what did you study in college?
I studied art history. My college did not have a journalism program at the time, but there was a council on the humanities that it was called, that visiting professors in journalism would visit and teach semester-long courses. And Some of my favorite classes were taught by different journalists, among them Scott Berg, the biographer, and Evan Thomas, then the managing editor at Newsweek. And they became mentors of mine and helped me transition after college to the journalism world. I don't think I knew then that I wanted to work in the arts specifically. I wanted to be a more, at least to start, a general assignment reporter. And so while I was at Columbia, I got an internship at the Daily Beast, Tina Brown's then brand new news website.
Wow.
I was intern number three. And I quickly realized that being in that fast-paced environment and being at like, it was an all hands on deck kind of experience. And I realized that it was where I wanted to be. Even as an intern, I could get, if you were just physically in the office, things would get thrown to you. And I was like, oh my God, I can't really go back to class. I convinced Columbia to let me tack on another semester and basically go part-time so that I could be at the Beast full-time. And then right after it was before I had graduated, before the graduation ceremony, they had hired me full-time and moved me to the West Coast Bureau.
Wow.
So Columbia mailed me my diploma. I didn't attend graduation.
What were you writing about?
Yeah, it was Tina's, you know, lifelong sensibility in that a blend of politics, books, celebrity culture. At the time, as an intern, you were kind of in this, like, I would say war room meets general, like, assignment desk. There was a thing called a cheat sheet, which was the backbone of the homepage, which was 10 news items a day. And I, for a while, was the morning, you know, there was a rotating desk. So you'd wake up morning cheat sheet editor, I guess you could say. So you'd wake up at, I think it was 4 a.m.
Well, I was going to say in LA too, you must have gotten up early.
Well, by then I was still in New York then. And you would just be like, okay, here's the international news. Here's the business news. And you would have to synthesize these 10 little mini blurbs. It was a boot camp in journalism. And, you know, stuff that I could never have learned in journalism school, I picked up there. I was very lucky because then Gabby Dalpelt had been hired as the West Coast Bureau Chief. And she was the one that was building out a team on the West Coast. And she came and interviewed me. She likes to say I was in the tiniest mini skirt when she interviewed me. I don't remember. Which, like, doesn't sound like me.
No, it doesn't.
But I was 23, so maybe. I somehow got the job and the Beast moved me to LA.
And what was that like?
I loved LA. My aunt Barbara was there by then, and her husband, my uncle Bert Fields, was an entertainment lawyer. And so they kind of took me under their wing, and it was really wonderful to have family there. But I think I learned really early on that I didn't want to cover Hollywood and entertainment. And so I set out as the assistant editor, kind of supporting the West Coast Bureau. It was Gabby as its bureau chief, Kate Arthur, a wonderful editor, and Nicole Laporte, a very, very talented journalist. And I was the only person that had worked at the company before as an intern. I knew a little bit of the operations side, and I kind of plugged in as this assistant editor. And they said it was a 3-month gig, and I stayed for 3.5 years.
Wow.
And I just learned the ropes from these three really talented women. We got really close. It felt like the tightest knit team. I think I learned then, and then through my next few bosses, what it feels like to be in, like, have a really good time at the office and have, like, humor be the backbone of your office culture and people be really good friends. And it was such a formative experience for me of what a workplace can feel like.
And so from there, 3.5 years there, where'd you go?
I sort of began to specialize in fashion and art coverage when I was there because they were so covered in Hollywood. And
yeah.
You know, and then the art world, at least in LA, was relatively nascent. It was like the heyday of Band of Outsiders and all these interesting brands and artists there. And I covered Mocha and all these things like that. And, you know, I specialized and became the fashion and art editor at the Daily Beast. And then the site merged with Newsweek magazine, and they asked me to edit the art and fashion pages in Newsweek simultaneous to the more daily web content. So I was working on, you know, weekly pages and the, you know, daily editorial on the website as well. And it was great fun. I had no experience and no business being a market editor or a fashion and art editor for Newsweek at such a young age, but it felt like it was an incredible opportunity. And I realized though that I wanted to do this professionally. There were not a lot of other jobs in LA in fashion and art, unless you went to work for the LA Times or something. So I kind of self-transferred back home to New York. By then I had met my husband and brought him with me, and we moved back in temporarily with my parents and on 19th Street. And then I went to work back at the East Coast office at the mothership of the Daily Beast. And then 6 months later, I went to go work for Stella Bugbee at The Cut.
Oh, wow. Wait, can I ask you a shallow question before that? How did your style change from your whole life in New York and then moving to LA? And then when you came back again to New York, did you notice a difference in how you dressed or what you needed that you couldn't find or what you missed?
It's a great question. I always felt like I was not casual enough for LA, but I remember struggling. And I also remember struggling, and this is the backbone of truly all of my jobs, that I couldn't figure out how to dress for work, for the person I was at work, the person I was after work, and the person I was on the weekend.
Yeah.
Like three different people, and they didn't share a wardrobe.
Right. And closets in New York are small.
Yeah, exactly.
That's an amazing person to work with, Stella. How long were you there and what'd you learn?
You know, I got so lucky with this like string of inspiring female bosses. Stella also, and The Cut was another example of an incredible workplace culture where I just had such a good time during the day. You know, there it was like just the funniest all the time, and the sensibility was amazing. And we had great fun. And so I started as an editor, kind of taking all of the fashion and beauty stories. And then we were publishing probably 30 to 40 news pieces a day. And then there would be longer features that we'd work on. And, you know, again, it felt just like being thrown things and learning from her and learning from another wonderful editor, Molly Fisher, who became a close friend, as well as the wonderful writers on the team, Allison Davis among them. And I really admire her work as well. And so it just felt like this team of interesting, smart women. But yet I also felt, you know, perennially, like I didn't really know how to dress in a way that was comfortable for the office, that could also serve me who I was afterwards. I didn't feel that I wanted to be corporate. You know, I didn't want to dress in a way that was overly, I don't know, like I was going to a corporate environment at all. And yet I wanted to feel polished. I didn't want to wear and couldn't wear designer clothes. I was like, what am I supposed to wear? I thought about it every day. And I'd say like such a moment of agita almost every morning getting dressed.
So while you were there, I mean, did people talk about their clothes, their own clothes, other than what you're writing about in an environment like that?
Honey, I don't have too many memories being there of like what we were wearing so yeah. much. More just like getting really excited about emerging brands yeah. in New York and or elsewhere, and being really plugged in with fashion news. And in that way, I felt like if I had a journalism education or background of the Beast, I obviously built that up at The Cut as well. But I also got a real fashion education there.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, the sheer volume of stories that we published just meant you had to be all over the beat in a way that I hadn't been before. So I feel like I got a full education in the industry.
And how long were you there?
Almost 3 years, I believe.
Okay. And then from there?
Then I went to T Magazine. I was hired by Deborah Needleman.
Awesome.
to join the digital team at T.
Deborah at T, that must have been a completely different, I mean, she has a totally different perspective, I guess.
Yeah, it was a slower paced environment that was more features forward and less news responsive. And obviously being within the New York Times and suddenly in a place with other sections and other desks and being a features magazine within the paper, you know, there were just all sort of different rules of the road. And it was another really like fascinating time of how just learning the operations inside a different magazine and being on the digital side. I helped this small team, figure out its web presence and how the digital publication differed from the magazine, et cetera. And then I stayed at T for 5 years.
What was the biggest skill that you learned there?
I feel that I focused on a different side of the fashion world at T. It was a little less newsy, and there were different creators and makers and artists that were kind of the T sensibility, and I feel like it was a kind of an education in a different set of creative talent, and it felt very global, which was I was very grateful for. And so I grew to be the digital director under Hanya. My focus was really finding writers and assigning writers in a range of cities on different topics. So, and starting franchises, I would say. It would be like I started a newsletter called The Tea List there that was what editors within the magazine and contributors were recommending in a range of fields. Deborah asked me to produce two virtual reality films actually at the height of VR. So that was an amazing experience. It was kind of just a wide range, and then contributing to the magazine, working with styles was really wonderful as well. It was a pretty diverse range of roles within 5 years.
So tell me about the birthday gift that changed the course of your career.
My best friend, Danny Shea, on my 33rd birthday, he gave me a session with a career coach. And her name was Joanna Bloor. She had a track record of working with C-suite executives and, these very high-level individuals. And I'm surprised that she took my call because I was a, lowly editor.
When you got the gift, had you had a conversation with your friend and said, like, I'm just feeling, stuck, or like, what was the impetus for that?
Yeah, I was so happy at T, and I love the people, and I loved what I was doing. I was just more in a place of I don't know what the next 10 years looks like. I don't know what the next 20 years looks like. It was more just a moment of searching and wondering what was next.
Did you have children at this point?
I had a one-year-old daughter, and I got on the phone with this woman, and she said, what I want the one of the first questions she said, how old are you? And I said, I'm 33. And she said, okay, I want you to close your eyes and imagine yourself at 50. And I closed my eyes and I imagined my daughter being 18. For some reason, I imagined myself looking out the window at her in a backyard of a non-specific place. I had this very, very specific image in my mind, and she like all this time had gone by. She was big. And Joanna said, what do you want your life to look like at this moment? You have this 18-year-old daughter. Who are you professionally? And I said, I will have started a business and written a book. And it just came out, and I had no idea that it was in me. I maybe if not for the visualization, I would have had a totally different answer
Yeah.
that more resume specific. She was like, oh, wow. Okay, that's the case. You need to get started because 17 years goes by in a flash, and you have to lay the groundwork now and begin building the person in the career that you want to be at 50.
And did you have any indication that you wanted the business to be a fashion business?
Not specifically. She at that point said, I think you should take time off and figure out and just talk to people. And so that became my focus for the next 6 months was research and kind of reporting. It was what I already knew how to do and just talking to smart people and asking. And I ended up talking to a lot of women about fashion and what they felt was missing from their wardrobes, but also their lifestyles more
Yeah.
broadly, who they were becoming, how they transition between these different selves, between their work self, their personal, it felt like a degree in anthropology over 6 months. And it's something that I would never have allowed myself in my everyday, day-to-day, putting out fires,
Yeah.
job. And it was during that 6 months that this idea began to form.
And was your husband supportive in the process, or were your parents supportive?
Absolutely. I think they were a little freaked out. I left without a specific, after the career that I had had of always going to the next thing, I think there was an expectation that I go work at another publication, but they were very patient with me.
So how did you begin to set up the infrastructure of this phantom business?
It was a very, very simple idea at first. I wanted to make one shirt. In my mind, it was something that could be, it was a mid-weight fabric. It had a very specific thing in my mind. It was a pop-over shirt that could be worn over a bathing suit. It was a kind of, I thought it would be in herringbone, and I thought it would be in cabana stripes. Like bright stripes and entirely unisex, and something you could ball into your beach bag or wear to lunch over a wet bathing suit.
And was it sort of a tunic, or was it tuck in short?
Almost a tunic, pop over, single button, kind of fell open, no bib. And this was probably a mistake in hindsight, but I was convinced that it had to be unisex because, and I've since learned that unisex is a nightmare. But the idea was simple, and I found a wonderful partner who helped me then connect to fabrics, and found basically the fabric that I wanted to be in, and a wonderful mill who would help me develop it. And we went back and forth for months. And again, the idea was just to create one shirt, and I thought I was going to make 50 of them, give them to friends and see what they thought. And there was going to be no selling. There was going to be no name. There was going to be no business. And at the exact moment that I found this wonderful fabric and wanted to make it in these five cabana striped colors, COVID happened and the mill shut and everything stopped.
Were all of the choices, I guess, were you adamant about yes, no, this is right, this is not right? Like, was it innate? Did you know it every single step along the way? Were you clear?
I was surprised that yes, somehow I knew it was really about fabric at the beginning, and it actually is still really about fabric today. And I just knew early on that what I didn't want things to feel like. And I have since really honed that, but it was there at the beginning.
You were designing yourself, or did you have a partner in that?
I had a technical designer who had experience in product development. The mill, so everything closed down for close to a year for quarantine. And in that year, I was thinking that I would give 50 shirts away to friends in June of 2020. Ended up being June of 2021, giving us an entire extra full year to develop. And in that year, I realized I wanted to add shorts and a caftan and a linen fringe dress and a sailor top and some kids stuff. And it became a full brand in a full year, a full world in a way. And, it would have happened like that had it not been for, this quiet period.
And also, don't you think having your voice as a writer maybe made you more confident about your point of view?
It's funny. I've never thought of it like that. I think in a way I feel like what I'm doing now is it's storytelling in a totally different medium and just not using words. But the story in the world is still there.
So you had the challenge of the pandemic. What were the internal challenges that you faced as you started the business? Did you ever doubt yourself?
Oh, all the time. Still do. No, I think, and this might be true of others who have performed a massive career switch or transition, but there was a lot of imposter syndrome, just kind of coming online as a new designer and with a company in a field that I had no professional experience in. And I think for that reason, I still don't really refer or see myself as a fashion designer. And it might be that that's part of the imposter syndrome speaking, because that's literally what I now do as a day job. I always kind of thought that, oh, this is a lifestyle brand. This is, we just happen to make clothes. Here's the world. And I think I was creating this full world so as not to just be straight ready to wear. And I think in hindsight, though, that paid off, because it actually speaks to my interests too. You know, I care a lot about music and food and design and women and meeting people. And it's all part of the same brand. It's not just this super, I would say, pure focus on ready to wear. Although that is, of course, the backbone of what we do. It feels like a bigger world.
You started to sell exclusively online, and then this is during the pandemic, I would imagine, still. Yes.
Coming out of the pandemic, I think that was part of the nice timing, was that it was a very travel minded capsule wardrobe, right as people were like,
get me out of here.
Yeah, get me out of here.
How did you see the clothes on people, and how did you start to understand what was working and what wasn't working?
So we launched online in June of 2021, and we had great press right at the beginning, but it—
Which can be good and bad, right? If you're not ready for it.
Yeah, we were, luckily we had the inventory and we were ready for it. And it was very exciting, but it was also, and we, being direct, we kind of knew who our clients were right away. And I remember within the first 2 days, we had people saying, oh my gosh, I'm going on a boat tomorrow. Can you messenger the fringe dress to me at my house? And I remember walking a fringe dress up to someone's house, and these people are going to call the police because they ordered something online that is being hand carried to them within 20 minutes. But you know, it was amazing to see right away this kind of response. But of course, it really took time to take a step back and think about who our clients really were and what they needed and how they actually wanted to shop.
Your first thought was, I'm going to make these shirts for my 50 friends. And then it becomes your 50 friends have them, but then it grows. And then you don't know that the circle outside of that. And then you don't maybe really even know what they want. Also, that first collection can be successful, but then you've got to do a second collection. And
absolutely. And then I was like, oh my God, we need to be, we're now 6 months behind.
Yes, exactly.
Second collection. Hadn't occurred to me to do a second collection. And you're absolutely right. At the beginning, I looked at Attersea as this resort-minded, escapism-inspired, more travel-aligned brand. And it was a surprise to people when, for the second collection for fall, we launched cashmere. And it was wrap coats and the same popover shape, but in cashmere and drawstring pants. And, but it was this, it spoke to set dressing in the same way that the striped collection had. It spoke to like ease of, which is a very, very central value for me, is like how I just want everything to kind of go together easily. You don't have to stress about what to wear. And I can talk more about that, but that was really, I think, born from my struggles getting dressed every morning, was this philosophy around ease. And so the second collection, while the fabrics were totally different, had the exact same, these different tonal sets. There were like, you know, popover and drawstring pants and wrap coat in camel color, in gray, and in navy, and in charcoal. And women just started buying these full sets, and they were much more expensive. And I was shocked by it.
And so in a way, you had this idea at first, but it sounds like the idea sort of morphed as you went along, and you realized that what you were solving was a different thing than what you thought you were doing.
Absolutely. It felt responsive to what people were buying to some degree, but also what my evolving interests and evolving seasons
and learnings. I mean, you were learning some. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so by collection three, we introduced a sculpted vest. So this was our second summer season, which was the introduction of tailoring, you know, and so it was still an edited collection, but there were now tailored trousers and a sculpted vest, which in the same way were still the set dressing, but in a much more elevated way. because these two pieces went together beautifully, and yet they were not in the same fabric and a prescriptive set, if that makes sense. And it was then that we started seeing people really buy them together. They looked so flattering on a range of body types. People really responded to this silhouette. And then came the question, where can I try this on? I had rented a tiny little office space on the fourth floor of a building on 64th and Madison. The only reason I had rented it was because A, it was close to where I lived, and B, because I had these different freelancers at that point and consultants who were all working separately. And I realized how fun I really wanted to emulate the office cultures that I had been brought up on. And I wanted us all to be together. And in my mind, it was also C, a great deal because of COVID and landlords, things having changed, landlords having a really, really different attitude about office leases. And I signed this. It was the top floor. It is the top floor of this little townhouse building above a restaurant. And we started co-working there. And then customers began to ask if they could try things on that they had seen online. And we have a warehouse in Bergen, New Jersey. And we were began to get use their quite expensive messenger service to bring pieces in for people to try on in the studio, and or the it was then the office, and it was a former fitness studio, and there were reps written on whiteboards, sliding doors, and so I used screens to block off the vantage point of customers when they would exit the elevator, and there would be a tiny little rack with the four things that we had called in from the warehouse. And there would be a screen leading you to the bathroom, which is how you would try things on. And we hoped you didn't see our desks or anything like that. And then we could check you out via invoice or whatever to your email. And so that began, and it was very, very imperfect. And but then what started happening was that it happened every 2 weeks, and then every week, and then multiple times a week. And we realized then and there, this needs to close and become a real retail space.
Wow. So what was a moment in those early days when you knew that you were on the right path? Was it that when you realized people were coming every day and that things were fitting and people were loving things?
Well, it felt real when the first person that was not a family member, for sure. And I think my mom was our first order online. But it felt I was really obsessed with like overhearing what women were saying and wanting to work with clients myself, and and I still feel that way, and it just always feels exciting with every client and every purchase, and I don't know when that will wear off, but it hasn't yet.
I'm th almost 30 years in. It hasn't worn off on me.
inspiring to hear. So I guess in that sense, that was when it felt real, when people started coming in who I didn't know.
What's been the most difficult part about learning a new industry mid-career?
I think there's just a massive amount of technical knowledge that I feel, again, like I'm in boot camp of. I feel like I'm in sophomore year of college, and I am in awe of many of my colleagues with who have gone to school and have, such incredible technical skills. I think part of it too is the to speak to the bravery thing. I think I in a way I feel like I because I was a new arrival in the industry, I didn't really know how things worked. And in a way it just allowed my naivete allowed for me to do things a little differently. And it was really just because I didn't know how things were done. And for that reason, it was just, okay, we're going to focus on product and we're going to focus on getting it to the customer. And it was like, this is just the easiest, not easiest, but kind of most straightforward thing. And we're going to produce collections up until the point when they're for sale. And then at some point, last minute, we're going to try to shoot them. And then we're going to release them for sale. And so it made the timeline very, very crunched and very last minute. And now, of course, we've spent several years, I would say, adapting to the real ecosystem of the business. And, you know, we're now on the wholesale calendar and working several seasons in advance and a bit more organized. But those early days were certainly a challenge.
What would you share with somebody who's starting out on a new career journey and might be experiencing imposter syndrome?
You know, I would say that the hardest part for me was starting. And the mentally, it's always this question of what's the first step. And I feel like I talk to a lot of people who have great ideas for businesses or books they want to write, and they can't really get it off the ground because they don't know the entry point and they don't know how to start. And I feel that they're is never a perfect place to start. It's just often talking to people, putting one tiny foot in front of the other. Mm-hmm. I remember a friend who became editor-in-chief of a magazine, this is several years ago, called me and said, God, it's not perfect. I don't know what to do. And I just remember saying, like, you've just ripped the Band-Aid. You know, it's going to be so far from perfect for so long. But the thing is you probably won't have a ton of customers or a ton of readers or whatever right at the beginning. You will have to build it over years mm-hmm. with your clients or your readers or whatever. And as you're building it and responding to that feedback, you'll get more and more perfect or whatever, or closer to the quality that you desire. But at the beginning, you know, it's letting good be the enemy of great or whatever the phrase is. But I had a friend who also gave me really great advice early on, my friend Kyle. I was hand-wringing about what my next step would be after I had left the journalism world and I was figuring out what the brand would be. And he said, Isabel, remember, nobody cares. And it is, to this day, one of the best pieces of advice I've ever received, because it's so easy in your own head to be like, oh my God, people are watching. Everyone's like wondering what my next move is going to be. And the reality is no one is waking up in the morning and making eggs and being like, is Isabel Wilkinson starting a business today? Like, no one has ever said that in the history of the world. No one cares. And so if you can just wake up in your day and do the thing in your waking hours that you're really excited about. Yeah. And for me, it was sourcing great fabric and focusing on making great things that I wanted to wear and that my friends wanted to wear. And that's still how it feels to me. It's like, and that's just what gets me excited. And in a way, the beginning, and people are like floored that I didn't have any kind of master plan. when I started out, and it really just felt so personal. It was like, what are the things that I want to make? And if I put my head down, and COVID was certainly, I would say, a cloak in many ways of for people who were putting their head down and wanted to create something privately.
Yeah.
And it was this open time and this cloak of anonymity in a way. And I said, if I wanted to just put my head down and make the things that I want to make, and that makes me happy and feel fulfilled in my waking hours, you know, then that's enough. And I think that to me is the advice that I impart on our people who are starting a new venture, because you just have to be really excited. And I know it's such a cliche, but what gets you out of bed in the morning?
And I think there's something also that I tell entrepreneurs a lot. You have to be a little bit careful who you share your plans with, even the people you love the most that love you the most, because I think that they can be afraid of your failure. They don't want you to get hurt. Every time I talk to my mom about starting the store, my mom would be like, I don't think it could work. You know, like there's every reason why it couldn't work. And it's not because she didn't believe in me. It's because she didn't want me to get hurt. And so you have to, for me, I feel like you have to be a little bit careful about how many people you share it with almost.
Absolutely.
What have you learned about yourself in the last 5 years that you didn't know?
For me, it's that I think there was a lot of part of the imposter syndrome was, I don't know how to do this. What are you doing? why are you doing this? You don't know what you're doing. And overriding that voice and just realizing you actually really do know the difference between, it's not right or wrong. That's the question. It's what's right to you. And I think the closer you can feel to that voice every day, whether you're talking to a colleague in an HR capacity or picking fabrics or talking to a client and helping them style themselves, it just, you know, I would get very nervous at the beginning with when, you know, as much as I love talking to clients, I would get very nervous when they would ask me for what styling and direct styling advice on what to buy, because I'm not very salesy and I don't, you know, I would be like, oh, I don't know, talk to someone else. Like, I can't help you. Like,
I mean, I kind of do that too, because I'm like, I'm not even really that into fashion. I'm actually just into solving problems.
Totally. And I would get quite nervous. And then I would say, yep, no, you know what? Like, you actually do kind of know what you think is right. And you're just being nervous about not wanting to seem a certain way once you kind of override those doubts, I think you get closer to your truest self in a way.
What did you wear to prom?
Oh God. I wore a dress that was far too sexy for prom. I will find a picture. It was a green, bright, bright green.
Like Kelly dress. Green?
Kelly green.
That's really and bold. I love that.
Kelly green with these little diamond straps and backless and not diamond strap, whatever, rhinestone yes. straps and
Diamante.
And a smoky eye
like, was it long?
It was a long dress. I can definitely find a photo.
Fabric.
And it was a kind of chiffon, of course. And
was it vintage or new?
It was new. I'm trying to remember where I purchased it and I don't remember. But I think that was the last time I've ever worn that bright a color.
Thank you, Isabel, so much. I love talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a great conversation, and I'd love to chat more when I see you.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. Please follow us on Instagram at What We Wore Podcast for additional content and show updates. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.